Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB, Saturday, August 10th, beautiful Saturday. With me is Tom, running the board and the video and all the other special effects we'll have today.
I might even get in some whipping sounds like I have accidentally done before.
We do Morning Zoo occasionally when the computer malfunctions. It's the illusion of radio.
That's right, the magic of live.
But what I do want you to do, Tom, is I want you to help me a second here. Let's take a... as we do every week here on Flashback Twin Cities. Again, I am Tom Osman. And we're going to take a step back to August 4th, 1975. And some of us may or may not have been here. We may have been conscious for one reason or another, or not conscious.
I was definitely not conscious. Well, not a chance.
We'll get to that later.
Sure.
But let's take a listen to what we would have been listening to or watching on Channel 4 News on August 4th, 1975.
From WCCO Television News, the Northwest Communications Center, this is The Scene Tonight with Dave Moore reporting.
Northwest says the first day of the pilot strike will cost it $2.5 million, a loss that will be sharply reduced when the company's mutual aid pact with other airlines takes effect tomorrow. The 1,500 pilots, of course, are losing lots of money. And as Sam Ford reports now, the passengers weren't without some pain themselves.
The day began with several Northwest pilots picketing at various locations around the airport. As the pickets paced, the passengers waited at Northwest ticket counters. Some of the passengers were lucky, getting to leave on one of the three flights out. All to Chicago, all flown by supervisory personnel. Others weren't so lucky. They stood in lines, wondering whether Northwest would allow them to use another carrier or leave them stuck in the Twin Cities.
Well, I was supposed to leave today for Montreal, and I didn't know which flight was on, so I had to call over town.
You know, I can pull video from the website from any era, and there's always a Northwest strike going on at the airport.
It does kind of seem like a Minnesota tradition, don't you think?
The fantastic thing is that in that video, you see people at a counter actually helping people help them get tickets, and that's that you don't get to go actually even talk to a human being.
You're blowing my mind.
I know.
That doesn't happen.
We have on our guest, we have a guest today. He is the news director during this time, August 1975. My guest today, Ron Hanberg. Welcome to Flashback Twin Cities.
Thank you very much, Tom.
I want to read the bio that is on the Paddock Museum website. Ron Hanberg is that rare journalist who found his way to the top and never lost sight of the powerful relationship a television station can have with its community. Under his leadership, WCCO-TV created the region's largest investigative journalism unit and launched such award-winning mainstays as the I-Team and Dimension Features, as well as the Moore Report documentaries. Hanberg graduated from the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and began his broadcast career in 1960 as a news writer and reporter for WCCO Radio. He moved to CCO-TV in 1964 and by 1971 had become its director of news and public affairs, later rising to vice president and general manager. He also served as WCCO's on-air editorial voice. Thanks to his strong commitment to journalistic ethics and to innovate, high-quality news and public affairs programming, the station won 5 National Emmy Awards, 5 Peabody Awards, and numerous other during his tenure, while producing journalists that went on to jobs with all the major networks. He left in 1989, but returned to TV in 1993 to help launch the award-winning Newsnight Minnesota at TPT. He's also an author of 4 mystery novels, each drawn from his background in investigative journalism. It's quite a background, Ron.
Yeah, it only proves that I'm old.
You know, well, we call it seasoned, we call it experienced. We don't use the word old at KLBB. Our music is not old, it's experienced.
I believe, to quote another thing, Jerry, let's see, chronologically enriched.
Yeah,
look at
great.
That. There we
good,
go.
Good, I like that.
Ron, this newscast we're watching here, this was the first time that local news was on for an hour in evening. And what was this your innovation?
Well, The Scene Tonight, which originated in a 45-minute fashion, debuted in 1968. And we had great success with The Scene Tonight in 45 minutes. It It won the ratings consistently. It kind of plowed new ground in television journalism. And as things happen, upper management thought, well, if it's successful at 45 minutes, why don't we make it an hour? And I must have agreed with that because we did it. But it turned out, I think, to be a real mistake. It was simply too much at that time of night, especially against the syndicated shows that were running against it.
Or the big one, Johnny Carson.
And Johnny Carson, but Cheers was on at that time. There were a lot of alternatives from 10:30 to 11. And the result of going to that hour was that our 10 o'clock ratings were diminished simply because of the length of the newscast. And so from a ratings point of view, it was really a bad move. But I think it also served, to those who were watching, it served a nice purpose. We did a lot of interesting sidebar kinds of features.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one in specific. It was called Case Unsolved, which was really the forerunner of the cold case kind of phenomenon today that you see so often, where we went back and tried to resurrect some unsolved crimes. But there were other things that we did: movie reviews and play reviews and a lot of non-really spot news kinds of things.
A lot of information in 1 hour.
Absolutely. And I think it added to the fabric of the newscast, but there were some downsides to it.
And this is an era, there was not even a 5 o'clock news in this era. There was only 6 and 10, if you're looking at 1975. This is before 5 o'clock newscasts were common.
Right. And then, as now, ratings were very important. So you had to try to balance...
Mm-hmm.
Serving the community, if you will, but also remaining competitive. Thankfully, we had local ownership that was committed to serving the community and serving what the FCC wants us all to do, and that is serve the public interest.
And to put this into context, if you think about this year, 1975, and we're going to go backwards and forwards eventually here, but there's two stations in town. There's Channel 4, Channel 5, both locally owned, and Channel 9 was, I guess they were the only out-of-town owners, but Don Schwartz was here, and he was running it tightly, you could say that. So it wasn't a three-way news race. It was a two-way news race.
In those days, it was, before CARE really became a factor.
Mm-hmm.
Channel 9 was never really the competitive race with Channels 4, 5, and eventually 11.
And even when ABC was number one, their news department still was not able to...
Exactly. Run. And CCO has always benefited from CBS and the dominance through the years of CBS, but the downside of that was that CBS always tended old mm-hmm. in its audience. And those old lead-ins led to the Scene Tonight or to the 10 o'clock report, whatever you... And so we were, in a way, the victims of the aging CBS demographics.
When innovation like an hour-long newscast doesn't work, whoever says, you know what... This didn't work, or is there... Who admits this was a mistake?
Well, I think in this case, it was eventually the general manager.
Mm-hmm.
On the basis of a lot of things, some of which I was not privy to, really made that decision. We tried in the news department to do our best with the hour. But we didn't really increase staff when we went from 45 minutes to an hour. So it put more pressure on the staff that existed. And in a way, I think... adversely affected what we did in the first 45 minutes.
Well, in the clip we just watched, this is film. This wasn't a videotape that you shot with a beta cam, came back to the studio, and popped it into a machine. This was all film. This means it had to be developed, processed, and cut before it could be on this hour-long newscast. There's a lot of manual work that was done these days in order to make that hour happen.
Absolutely. It was, in those days, we were in the basement of the station on 9th Street, and the film processing was in one part of the newsroom, and we had low ceilings. We had an environmental engineer who came in there one time who said it was absolutely the worst working conditions he'd ever seen, because you had all the fumes from the film processor. You had film sometimes when the processor wasn't drying the film hanging all over the newsroom before mm-hmm. it was edited. And, of course, getting it cut, and often we were doing two and three reels simultaneously,
right,
which had to get up to the projection room. it was a madhouse. I mean, frankly, it's the whole advent of tape and then digital and all the rest has changed the business dramatically from when I was really in that old newsroom.
Let's talk about that a little bit. You went to the University of Minnesota, graduated, and we were just talking off air before the show started. You didn't have to go to Fargo, didn't have to go to Des Moines, Iowa, before you came to the Twin Cities. You got to stay in your hometown and work not only for us, even for CCO Radio.
Which at that time was, of course, the dominant radio station in the
country.
I was very lucky, without going into great detail. I had done a paper for a class at the University of Minnesota, and the news director at that time, WCCO Radio, Jim Borman, had come to speak to the class, and the instructor showed him this particular piece of writing I had done. And he offered me, on the basis largely of that, and I must have interviewed him, I suppose, too, but a summer replacement job at WCCO Radio as a writer and reporter. And that led then to a full-time offer. I was telling you earlier that I had two offers when I graduated, one from to go to the Associated Press in Fargo. This is now 1960. Go to the AP in Fargo for $78 a week, mm-hmm. or to stay at WCCO Radio for $102.50 a week. I should have really been offered $92.50.
Wow.
And, of course, $25 a week in those days, that made the decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, in effect, cast the what my life was going to become. But even earlier, just out of how a teacher, I'm a great fan of teachers, and I think there's not a person among us that's not been affected in some really dramatic way by a teacher. And in my case, it was in seventh grade at Robbinsdale High School, when the teacher passed out pictures taken from magazines at that time, Look and Life and so forth, and the assignment was to write a story about the picture that you were given. And I was given a picture of two GIs going through the jungle. And the teacher was so impressed with the story I had written, she called the assistant principal into the classroom, Mr. Nellis, I'll never forget.
I thought they're only called in for bad minutes. They should call those
you
in.
You walk in, you're right. Like, oh, what did I do?
To congratulate me on this story. And, of course, I ran upstairs to try to join the high school newspaper and was too young. But that moment, in a way, when someone actually acknowledged that maybe I could write, in a way, led my life. And in a way, that experience at the university was the same way. It led me into broadcasting as opposed to newspaper work or wire service work.
Did you go to college thinking you'd be into broadcasting, or were you looking to be a writer?
I was looking to be a writer. I pictured myself early before marriage and all as a foreign correspondent. I had all those kind of grandiose dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And by then, I was fairly convinced that I could write. And it was then a matter of where. But once I got to CCO Radio, I fell in love with broadcasting. The immediacy of it, the contact you had with the audience. But you had a lot to learn. I'll tell you one little story. When I was very young at CCO Radio, the late Arv Johnson and I were working on a Saturday morning.
And Arv Johnson, the state capitol correspondent.
State capitol correspondent, mm-hmm. but also worked in the newsroom on Saturday morning. And there was a fire at the Sabathany Baptist Church, and I was sent out about 5 in the morning to cover it and to do in a phone report. And I was very young, very inexperienced. And, of course, there were no cell phones in those days, so I conned my way into a home to use their phone. But I could not get it straight whether it was Sabathany or Sabathini. And this lady in the house was just befuddled by my inability. And Arv Johnson, back at the station, finally said, "Ron, just come on back and write the story." So there's growing pains, and I went through a lot of them.
Our guest today, Ron Hamburg, the former news director and general manager of WCCO TV Channel 4. You left CCO Radio to join CCO TV. Was that on your request, or did they say, "This guy, he's got something going on, let's bring him to TV"?
The latter, really, although it wasn't very easy. Joe Bartlemy, who was then news director, Raleigh Johnson was news director, and Joe Bartlemy, associate news director at CCO Television, wanted me to come work weekends while I was working the week at CCO Radio. But at that time, there was such a barrier between CCO radio and CCO television that no one was allowed, with I guess the exception of Roger Erickson perhaps, to go from one to the other.
Or even to be allowed that they exist, because Steve Cannon will say that when he was doing radio for CCO radio, or even KSTP AM, you couldn't talk about last night's TV shows because in the radio world, TV didn't exist.
Exactly. There was no television set at WCCO radio in those days. They did not allow it. So the only way I got to go to WCCO television was by a decision at the highest levels of the company that they would agree to this kid going from one to the other. It was hilarious, actually.
But at that point, TV was still in its, we'll call it its high school years. I mean, TV had been around, I'm not trying to date anyone here, but TV had been around 20 years or so.
Right.
In even the how to make money at TV was still being explored. News was very sponsor-driven. The sponsor got more prominence in the beginning of a newscast than, say, who your reporters or even your lead story. So the radio business model was mature. I mean, it evolved after TV, but it was mature. It had been around since the 20s. So you come to WCCO-TV in the 60s, and were you there as a reporter or a journalist? What was it that you were doing there?
In those days, you really did both. I was reporting. I was producing newscasts. You did a little bit of both, or all things, actually. Mainly, I was producing newscasts, and that really set... That's how I spent basically my career, producing newscasts, writing for Dave Moore and the others, doing some reporting, and then into management. So,
how was producing for Dave Moore and writing for Dave Moore?
I can't tell you how wonderful it was.
It could have been easy.
No, he was a little cantankerous at times, but what he could do with the words that you wrote was astounding. I said at his, when he left the 10 o'clock news at his party, I said he could make a bad writer sound good and a good writer sound great. I've never heard anyone who could bring life to words as Dave Moore did. So it was a great pleasure. And
what an asset to this community. I mean, that we had the...
Oh, absolutely. You know, but he was also very funny. He always wondered why we missed stories that the Star Tribune would have. And I would try to say, well, Dave, we have, you know, 12 reporters and they have 145. Well, that doesn't make any difference, doggone it. And then he would always lament when we covered traffic fatalities, which I really understood, but was kind of part and parcel of the news those days. Until one day, there was an accident near his home in Edina. And he came into the newsroom before the 10 o'clock news wondering, why don't we have anything on that accident? Well, Dave, that's a story. You know, accidents affect people. And that's one of the reasons we cover them, I guess.
Well, you joined, you became news director and manager of Channel 4 in an era when consultants and formulaic news branding was becoming hot. You take L.A., New York, Chicago, the maggots of the world, their consulting groups came in, and it was eyewitness news, flash music. You avoided a lot of that, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that.
Well, we avoided it in the sense of we didn't avoid the consultants. Mm-hmm. We had consultants all the time who would help arrange the research we did, the focus groups, the other things, but also would be carrying to our station the lessons they supposedly had learned at other stations that mm-hmm. worked, mm-hmm. many of which we just simply did not agree with. It didn't match WCCO in our view. But they had an enormous influence on the industry in terms of anchor selection, of feature selection, and they still do. I mean, it's still clear when you look at Good Question, for instance. That didn't originate at WCCO, I'm almost sure. It came from somebody else, somewhere else. And that's pretty true of a lot of things. But they had influence, and the general managers listened to the consultants. They would come in for maybe a day every 2 months or a day every 6 weeks or 2 days and spend and look at your newscasts and look at the competition and then leave with these words of wisdom that the general managers would often listen to with great attention.
What I always find interesting, and people comment on videos we post here on tcmedianow.com, my guest Ron Hamburg, is you have out-of-town consultants that come in and then tell Minnesotans what Minnesotans like and don't like based on a focus group of 10 people or a survey. And I think that people never quite understand that because they'll be – Minnesotans take people that are on the news very – they take them to heart. You know, Dave Moore becomes a member of your family, you know, Bud Crayling, whoever it is. Then they get taken away and it's like a divorce or like some parent that moves away and you felt – this is how Minnesota is. We feel lost without them. So we always wonder, well, what research were you looking at that you told us we don't want to watch Dave Moore anymore? We don't want to watch these kinds of programs anymore.
Well, it varied. The focus groups I was always suspect of because, as you say, they involved 10, 12 people. And a lot of decisions were made based on their preferences.
Mm-hmm.
But we also did, obviously, much more detailed research that we tended to use the focus groups to confirm or deny. But, you know, you can't ignore the public taste either. It's, one of the great dilemmas for us, speaking of Dave Moore as we were, what do you do when Dave Moore is not as popular as he once was? And at 10 o'clock, at least, was not being as competitive as he once was. Yet he was a loved institution, loved mm-hmm. not only by the public, by those of us in the newsroom. But decisions had to be made in terms of the next generation, the next Don Shelby's, you know.
And it is business.
It is business. Of course it is, mm-hmm. yeah. And at least at WCCO, we tried to do it with as much
class
as we could.
We have a video on tcmedianow.com, and it's Dave Moore's final 10 o'clock newscast.
Mm-hmm.
And preceding that was an hour-long tribute to Dave.
Right.
That would never happen today. I mean, no matter who the anchor is today, they would never get that kind of sound.
No, they'd just
today.
Be in and out. You're gone now.
They are no longer with the company.
Right. And that certainly speaks to his specialness. Much the same thing was done with Shelby, of course. I mean, they had a week-long tribute to Shelby.
Who a special guest came on all week.
Right, exactly. So, and he deserved it, too. I mean, he had become not a Dave Moore institution, but an institution in this town. And you ought to have the chance to say goodbye to someone like that, or he or she ought to have the chance to say goodbye to the audience.
Mm-hmm. It's so closure for
it
us.
It is closure. But you're right. It's not done very often. But so many things in local television today aren't done as they once were.
Or in any business.
Or in any business, I suppose. But, you know, it's interesting that not one television station takes the time to do, even once a year, a documentary on some really important issue of this community. People do so-called investigative reports that sometimes have merit, sometimes don't. But
they do it in February, May, and November. And it's usually what is the flashiest thing that we can find? Mm-hmm. What's the one? There's a couple. I had Brian Lambert on a few weeks ago, and he was giving me his list of his favorite Sweeps Month stories. And I think one was housekeepers that didn't wear a lot, and this was a big investigative piece that
I remember
one
that
of our
one.
Stations did. And it's like, really? You pay them money, they don't wear tops when they vacuum your floors? I'm not trying to be embarrassing here, but that's sometimes what gets passed off as investigative journalism today.
The things I think we mentioned off air recently, very sadly, Mike Sullivan, who was director of public affairs at WCCO Television when I was general manager, but he had worked with me while I was news director. He died recently, very sadly, at a young age. But in those days, you know, we did the Moore reports.
Mm-hmm.
We did the Moore on Sunday shows. We did the studio shows where people could come forward and tell us what they didn't like about WCCO television, what we were doing wrong, as well as what we were doing right. And we did editorials. And that's what made, in those days, in my estimation, WCCO so special to this community. And in my estimation, it was largely because it was locally owned by families that cared about this community, who felt an obligation to serve it in whatever way. Sometimes, I mean, I did these editorials, some of which were absolutely contrary to what I know the owners believed.
You know what? I want to actually, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I actually want to play an editorial that you did, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the Renaissance era of documentary TV documentaries, because I think this is what Channel 4 really became. You know, these five Peabody Awards were not from housekeepers that were vacuuming hotel rooms. So let's take a break. We'll be back on Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB.